welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I'm Tyler Smith.
I'm David Batts.
And thank you for listening. David.
Yes.
How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Focusing on being a, you know, new year, new me.
Sure?
By which, I mean, I'm going to try and see as many new me Rapace movies as I can. I stole that joke. That's somebody else's joke from Twitter, but or from Blue Sky. I can't remember.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, I would absolutely buy that you said that you created that joke.
No, I do have something on my mind, but I want our... Well, we have a... You and I have a guest who is just, like you said...
Yeah.
It's just Scott. It's really the third chair of the show, but in my head, because I don't know. I used to, like, joke that I had OCD, and then I started feeling like, oh, that's unfair to people who actually have OCD.
Yeah.
But
then you took
I think I might actually have
a good long arc.
So, so in my head, if there can only be two hosts and one, like, at a time, so the third person is always the guest, even if it's Scott. But anyway, I do have something I want to talk about. Normally we do that before we bring in the guest, but I want Scott to weigh in on this. Welcome, third chair, Scott Nye.
Hello.
So, how are you, Scott?
Fantastic. How are you?
I'm good.
Fantastic. Oh, man.
I'm good. Yeah. I just got back from Sundance, and...
Congratulations.
Oh, boy, are my arms tired.
Yeah. Well, usually you have to say I just flew back in order for that joke to work. I just got back. You could have, you know, you could have run here.
Right. Yeah. Boy, my legs tired. Yeah. I've been going to Sundance. I've gone to every in-person Sundance since 2016, making this my seventh. Last year, my sixth, I noted that one of my favorite venues that Sundance used to use every year, which is the, it's called the Mark, the something something racquetball club. It's a guy's name. I can't remember what it is. But they literally turned like a basketball racquetball court into a screening room. And I saw a lot of great stuff there.
I like things going in that direction.
What?
As opposed to the other way around.
In that direction.
Yeah.
Get this athletic shit out of the way.
But what's funny is, like, you'd go to, like, an 8:30 a.m. movie, and it was just that one court they had blocked off. So people who, like, belonged to the racquetball club and, like, used the exercise, like, there are still people, like, on the indoor jogging track and stuff, like as you're waiting to get in to see, like, you know, Extremely Wicked, Shocking the Evil and Vile or something like that. Last year they stopped using it. And then this year, they stopped using Scott, who's been to Sundance in the past, might remember as the Yarrow. It then became the Park Avenue screening room.
Okay.
They stopped using that,
Have they replaced these with other venues?
No, that's
shocking.
I mean, they opened the Ray back in 2018, but that's still, I would say that's been long enough that's one of the regular venues. So the Yarrow, or the Park Avenue as it was known in later years, closing sucked because that was one they used as split some public screenings and some press and industry screenings.
Yeah.
They would do like the big ticket press and industry screenings. I saw like Call Me By Your Name in that room. I saw Landline, which that's a whole other like side discussion, like the movies that are a big deal and big ticket at Sundance and then get completely forgotten.
Sure.
But it was Landline at the time, like Julian Robespierre had a big indie hit with Obvious Child. Landline was her follow up and Jenny Slate was in it again. It was a big ticket at Sundance that year.
For sure.
And I thought it was a fine movie, but it kind of just fell off the radar. No one remembers Landline. Anyway, the point is, so that's a loss because now it means that there's one fewer P&I screening, and even the biggest the biggest ones are limited to how many seats are in the Holiday One or whatever the biggest theater that there is. So they've lost two venues and not replaced them. I think I can't remember if this is on the podcast or not, but TIFF is also down a net two venues since COVID. They've closed three and opened one. And the one they added is like great for convenience geographically, but it is like there's maybe three good sight lines in the entire theater. And like, you know, I saw Zone of Interest there and I still love the movie, but I'm like, I'm looking down at the screen from the side.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's not the point. The point is, like, down venues, which means they're down, probably down overall movies that they're showing. I know that's true of TIFF, that they show fewer movies. I don't know if that's, I haven't done the math on Sundance. Here in Los Angeles, we lost the LA Film Festival altogether. 2018 was the last one. AFI has gone from 8 days to 5 days, I think.
Yeah, that was even a pre-pandemic thing, I want to say.
I think you're right, but I can't remember. Yeah, but and maybe this is an episode, a full episode, but like film festivals, based on my anecdotal evidence, just seem to be contracting.
Sure.
I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
I feel like that is a full episode because I feel like it's part and parcel with contemporary cinema contracting. And, you know, I've read a lot of articles saying that there's just fewer buys happening at festivals and that it's just, there's just less money to go around for movies of that scale. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean it's a bummer for many reasons. I don't know, Tyler. Do you have any thoughts as someone who has not been to, I don't know, zero of these festivals? It's like you went to something at AFI Fest once, but
I think I might have. I don't remember what. Well, let me ask you this, because I don't know much about these festivals. But as Scott was mentioning, like there's fewer buys happening. Do you feel like maybe? Do you feel like the festivals have shifted a little bit from press and industry into more consumer stuff? And as such, maybe there's a little bit less interest on the part of consumers as opposed to industry.
Do you mean like...
like people that just attend the festival that have nothing to do with the industry?
But there's still, at something like Sundance, still most of those movies arrive at Sundance without distribution.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean,
there's
for sure the majority. There's a couple that have it, but yeah.
And sometimes there are movies that you find out get picked up like days before they premiere.
Yeah,
you
that
know?
Happens, yeah. But
yeah, I remember seeing, I guess this would have been 2019, Native Son, and HBO had picked it up right before and apparently had, I don't know, they must have had someone on site to rewrap a DCP and added they had the HBO logo on it like 24 hours after they had like acquired it, which is pretty impressive.
Well, I guess from that standpoint, as is always the case these days, I find myself wondering if the rise of streaming has made a difference in some way. Like these movies are like, oh, these are the big movies, and like, let's all go see these movies before everyone else. These big movies, like, well, are they going to be big if they're just shown on HBO? Like, is all of this? I mean, just like film itself, is all of it less of an event now? So people aren't quite so excited to go. I'm not sure. Like festivals, they're a culture in and of themselves. And it's a culture that I really don't know much about. I mean, obviously outside of the International Christian Film Festival, which is its own culture of people that are at a festival but don't watch movies.
I do feel like this could be a whole episode at some point. But it makes me sad, but also I'm like trying not to be like the old man and say things are better back. Like this is just what the landscape is right now, I guess.
I think it's, you know what? I'll be that old man. People being able to see more movies, that was better.
But, I don't know. I mean, it's still the festival. Like, it's the people who are going to the festival anyway. It's those people. It's not like... I would say the biggest one that bums me out is AFI being shorter. Because I feel like AFI... I don't know. I haven't done the math on if they're showing fewer movies overall, but it seems like these days, every movie they show once.
Yeah, there are a couple.
They had multiple screenings of things.
Yeah, there are a couple they'll show twice, but for the most part.
Yeah, yeah. And that's one of my favorite things about something like Sundance, where like you go in with a schedule, but suddenly everybody's talking about, you know, The Tale with Laura Dern.
Yeah.
And, like, you, like, rearrange your schedule to go to the P&I of this movie that everyone's buzzing about because they've already seen it. It's already screened a couple times. yeah, I missed that about AFI, about having more flexibility and seeing, having multiple opportunities to see movies.
Incidentally, I do have a story.
Okay.
That I don't think I've told on the show before.
Okay.
From the last time I was at ICFF, I was presenting at the awards. I was presenting the award for Best Actor, and as they know, whenever I present, I take the opportunity to say some things. And so I...
To give him what for? Give him a good scolding, a good chiding?
Kinda, yeah. And I had told the guy in charge, I was like, well, obviously, I feel like I got to say something. And he's like, I wouldn't have it any other way. I was like, oh, good, I'm glad. And so it was the 10th anniversary of the festival, and so they're really, like, playing that up. So as I went up, I was like, you know, it's the 10th anniversary of this festival, but do you know what it's the 50th anniversary of? The Godfather. And I was like, by a show of hands, how many people here have seen The Godfather? And about half of them put their hands up. I was like, all right. So that's half the number of people. That's half the audience at a film festival. That's a problem. And so we, so I kind of talked about that movie and the importance of seeing movies as a way of just getting to know movies better and making movies better. And then finally I was like, The Godfather also won Best Actor. Speaking of Best Actor. And so that's how I transitioned subtly back into my thing.
Well, I think that's a good place to take a break and talk about tweakedaudio.com. Tweakedaudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great. I use them each and every day of my life. Normally, I have a lot of things to choose from, but we're recording much earlier in the day than we usually do. So I can only say I was listening to an album called Obsession Destruction by a band called Chained to the Bottom of the Ocean. And it was very good and very heavy. It sounds like you would imagine a band called Chained to the Bottom of the Ocean would sound like. Really liked it. Sounded great on my tweakedaudio.com earbuds that are available at a low, low price at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that already low, low price. And no shipping charges, so please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season 2 of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Okay, we're back, and we're ready to jump in to today's topic, which I'm going to tell you what it is. I'm going to tell you what the topic is right now. First, I want you to take a glance down at your MP3 player, your smartwatch, whatever your...
Which will also tell you the topic of the episode.
don't read too far.
Just read the episode number,
and you'll notice that the episode number ends in a zero. And yet, you'll notice that the number before that zero is not a zero and is also not a five. And what that means is that this is a profile episode. This is where we profile the career of a film-related artist who has passed away recently. Today we are taking on the late great British filmmaker, at least one person said the greatest British filmmaker. Didn't Jonathan Rosenbaum say something like that?
That sounds like a Jonathan Rosenbaum.
Just a thumb in the eye to Hitchcock, I guess.
Maybe David Lean.
We're talking about the late Terrence Davies. Which does mean, yes, as Scott has pointed out to me privately, we've done a lot of men in a row for these profiles. But, like, look, I can't control who dies. I mean, you don't want me to.
You know, you're a free agent out here in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess,
Jane,
look.
Jane Campion, watch your back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just women get to die, I guess. We did Straub Huillet, but that was because Straub died.
Yeah.
Not Huillet died in 2014, I think. So I cannot remember when was the last time we profiled the career of a woman. But, I mean, that's just who's dying, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, it's also your fixation on keeping it someone who died between these episodes.
Yes, that's true.
Again, that's my OCD thing. Yeah, Tyler, I'm not going to say who, but Tyler suggested we do someone who had died before the cutoff for our next one. And I was like, in my head, I was like, we can't do that. That person died too early.
Well, and I'm fine with that rule. I just forgot when he died, because as I said to you the other day, time doesn't mean much for me right now.
Right. But after, because this is episode 880, then we already know who we're doing for 890. Again, we won't reveal that, but you know, follow me on Letterboxd and you'll be able to figure it out probably. But then we'll have a 20 week period between profiles.
Yeah.
Ladies, you got time.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I always enjoy those 20-week breaks that happen once a year or so, because I get to catch up on my unwatched Blu-ray collection.
Sure.
Because otherwise I spend so much time doing research. This time, because it was easy to do in terms of the length of Terrence Davies' filmography and also its availability, I pulled a Scott and I, and I went complete.
Hell yeah.
I watched everything, because it's all out there. So we're going to go chronologically, as we always do. Do we have any thoughts? I guess I want to say, like, I had only seen two Terrence Davies movies before he died. I had only seen The Deep Blue Sea and Benediction, which I guess was his last
one. Yeah.
Which are kind of the bookends of what I think of as like the second half of his career. Because we're going to get to a point where there's
a pretty big gap.
There's an 11-year break between narrative features. Yeah. There's one documentary in there, but there's an 11-year break, and which is broken by The Deep Blue Sea.
Yeah.
It's the first, and then Benediction was his last. And I absolutely loved Benediction on first watch. The Deep Blue Sea is a movie that I not knowing anything about him going in, I was almost, and also me being over 10 years younger than I am now, was almost a bit like caught off guard by his earnestness as a filmmaker. Mm. And The Deep Blue Sea took a while, took a second for me to really appreciate, because there's just so little irony, I think, to his movies. And I love that now. But I was very eager. Makes it sound like I was glad he died. But I was sad he died, but I was very eager for the chance to see how he became the filmmaker that I knew. And I was well rewarded. I don't know. Does anybody else have any? What were your thoughts before we embarked on this? What did you know of Terrence Davies when he died?
I had seen five of his films, his last four ones, and I caught Long Day Closed at the New Bev a long time ago. And I was always kind of mixed on him as a filmmaker, and I think I remain a little mixed. Deep Blue Sea was the first one I saw, and I loved it immediately. I mean, earnestness has never been a hurdle for me. That's something I appreciate. And which I think is more due to his generation than anything. Or that you're relaying that reminded me of an anecdote Rooney Mara told when she was prepping to do Carol. She'd already shot Song to Song with Terrence Malick, who was, you know, grew up in the 40s and 50s. And she was like, what's something about the period that you can tell me? And he's like, people just spoke more directly back then about themselves, about their feelings, about all that kind of stuff. I think that's something that Davies really brought throughout his career. I was really glad to see some of the earlier stuff, and most especially House of Mirth, which of course we'll get to.
Oh, okay. I'm interested to get to House of Mirth, because it sounds like we might have slightly different points of view. I don't know, Tyler, do you have any thoughts going in?
Yeah, so up until this, I had not seen any of his films. I was aware of him as like a very specific type of British filmmaker, not like Hitchcock, not like David Lean. Mm-hmm. The kind of beat, like, if you were to tell the average person, like, what kind of movies would a not Christopher Nolan British filmmaker make? This is, I think, what they would say. Like, these sort of conversational, usually period pieces. So that's kind of all I knew. Sadly, I've only seen four of his films. I wanted to try and see five so that I could see one from every decade. But I only saw four. But I think that was enough for me to know that he is now one of my favorite filmmakers of all time.
Nice. Well, let's jump into his short films at the beginning of his career. They have been compiled as the Terrence Davies trilogy because they are all autobiographical.
Yeah.
And somewhat chronological.
Yeah. And they fit nicely. Like, they're together, they're about an hour, 45 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. But I watched them as separate shorts. The first one is called Children. Most of the first half of his career, like, it seemed like he was almost strictly an autobiographical filmmaker. Children is about a young boy who is Catholic school, I guess, goes to Catholic school and is
kind of religious instruction.
But he's like a lot of what you'll see in his early autobiographical work is gay characters because Terrence Davies was gay. And
I was looking that up, actually.
Yeah.
I would venture to say he was asexual because he'd been with women, didn't really like that. And then he's on record as saying, like, he tried men. He wasn't really for me. And so I guess he did do that, but
yeah, that's interesting.
Didn't seem super interested in either one.
He, at least in the interviews I saw, he identified as gay, but had such a fraught relationship with that identification. Yeah. And you see that in a lot of his films he couldn't really settle into any kind of like steady relationship and pretty much became celibate after a point. Yeah. And I think what's great about these films, I mean, besides just like, and I'm going to have a hard time telling apart the short films because I did kind of watch them very close together. And they're all kind of the same style. They're all like full frame, black and white, very autobiographical. But you really see him explore that fraught relationship with his sexuality and like really feeling torn about his own comfort within that, about his place in society with that. And I think that's what made these the strongest of me of all his autobiographical films. They felt a little bit more self-reflective than the feature ones he'll get into. They're more kind of torn and complicated.
By the way, I can't think of a more British way of saying that you're, you know, either uncomfortable with that or just like not interested than like, oh, hey, here's an entire sexuality. And it's like, that's not for me.
Yeah.
That sounds very British to me.
In any case, Children, we'll start. Yeah, Children is about a child who, I don't know if the child's gay, but he's definitely bullied for being not enough of a masculine boy.
Yeah. Well, and the way he looks at some of the other boys, too, there's an indication that there's an attraction.
There's a lingering quality.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the short films, but you'll see it in later movies.
Yeah.
But what one thing that I think stuck out to me about watching these short films, only knowing Deep Blue Sea and Benediction, and Tyler, as you were describing his work, a lot of his work is very talky. Mm-hmm. The short films, especially the first two, a lot of the dialogue is sort of like off camera.
Yeah.
There's like you can see him. You can actually watch these three short films, and as much as they do work together, you can see a progression of him becoming more comfortable with film language and what he's willing to try. There's the Child and Madonna and Child. The second one are often more abstract. A lot of like off screen voices and long shots.
I think part of that though is just like budget of like you're shooting less sync sound, basically.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So then, yeah, Madonna and Child is, if I'm recalling correctly, Madonna and Child and Death and Transfiguration have the same actor playing.
That feels right, but I didn't check. I guess I can do so now.
I could be wrong, but yeah, Madonna and Child is, he's older and he's a clerk and he's taking care of...
same actor, yeah.
Yeah. Is this the one where his mother dies?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
In Death and Transfiguration. Yeah, I think it's his mother dies. And then Death and Transfiguration, the third one, which is one of my favorite of his films now, you really see his ambition grow. Because Death and Transfiguration takes place in two different timelines of both the older him and then the much older him on his deathbed. Dying, you see that, and also the thing that really comes to fore, it's been there the whole time, but like musicality and sound design are so huge to him.
Yeah.
There's so many, especially in his early work, there are so many scenes of group sing-alongs, or there's just a choral song on the soundtrack, and it's again that earnestness of not like, it's definitely like bold choices. Something subtle about the way he uses music in his movies, but it's often very beautiful, often group sing-alongs. I feel like as I was watching these movies, being like, hey, this is beautiful, but also as you were talking about, Scott, like people being different in the past, I was also like kind of mourning the loss of like monoculture.
Sure.
Like the idea that a bunch of people could be together in a room and just all know the words to the same song.
Yeah.
Like that doesn't really...
It reminded me of that scene from Lover's Rock.
Oh, sure.
Which I really loved.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's a great comparison. Another British filmmaker. Death and Transfiguration has a lot of that in the music, but also, speaking of sound design, it becomes almost a metronome in the final moments of the older hymns, like raspy dying breaths become.
Yeah.
There's a musicality and tempo to that. That's really, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Mournful and macabre, but beautiful and sad at the same time.
Yeah.
Those are the three, they're all on the Criterion Channel. I don't know. Tyler, you didn't watch them. Scott, did you have any other observations about the trilogy?
I think I was just really impressed with how fully formed he was pretty immediately, because by the time he made Children, let me double check the year it came out. Yeah, he was already kind of in his 30s, and this was like almost a second career to him, because he like worked as the film's getting into it, like just as a clerk for like 10 years of his young adult life.
Yeah.
Before transitioning into the cinema. And yeah, I don't know if he made like other short films like as a student or whatever, but like for this to be his first work, it's like, I mean, it's kind of all there right away.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, actually, I said yeah, but I don't, like I said, I do see a progression.
Oh, for sure. No, I mean, I see a progression throughout his career. I'm just saying that like you watch sometimes the early short films by major filmmakers and they're much less polished than Children is.
Okay.
Like the part that struck me right away is they're like a part in the bus, I think, or the subway. No, it's a bus because it's above ground, where you're just like watching a character from behind looking out a window, and there's like kind of a chorus going on behind it. It's just like the patience to stick with that shot.
Yeah.
And this wasn't like a time when slow cinema was as fashionable as it was today, is today. It's really breathtaking.
Yeah. And back of the head shots weren't as fashionable as they are now. I'm getting a little... this is a total aside, but I haven't done a movie journal in a while, so I haven't had a chance to talk about this. But I went into All Dirt Roads Taste of Salt really expecting to love it. It seemed like it was up my alley. But it feels like it's a little bit art house by numbers.
Yeah, it's fine.
A little bit.
I think
and there's so many following someone from behind the camera... trained in the back of their head, and that's become such an art house move lately. Anyway, that's not what this episode is about, but I wanted to be the All Dirt Roads hater on the podcast. Then we get into feature films. His first one is Distant Voices, Still Lives, which continues the autobiographical strain of his movies, which is mostly about family life, and Pete Postlethwaite plays the unkind drunken father.
Yeah,
that's very generous of you.
Yeah.
Yeah, he plays, well, the drunken part probably came pretty easily to Pete Postlethwaite.
Sure.
Yeah, what do you have? This is one of the ones you watched.
Yeah, yeah. I am furious at my current speaking limitations because I have so much to say and I want to say it all at once.
Okay.
Because it is overwhelming to me how wonderful this movie is. And all four movies that I saw, I loved all of them. And it should be noted that, like, the first one I watched was The House of Mirth. And I thought, all right, yeah, pretty straightforward, dialogue-driven. It's like, all right, I assume all of his movies are going to be like this. Mm-hmm. I was wrong. Because then I watched this. And it's, I mean, there's dialogue. I wouldn't say it's dialogue-driven by any stretch of the imagination. And it's not straightforward either. I feel like it's been a while, and David, you know this because I pitched an episode to you. I feel like it's been a while since I've seen a filmmaker capture the essence of memory like he does. Like the way it just jumps around, but not in a way that's jarring. Everything just flows into everything else. And it's something that we'll see in a lot of his movies, or at least, in, as far as I know, two more of his movies after this. And it's just, it all just blends together so beautifully. And so it's like, okay, he does memory well. And then his ability to capture the complexity of relationships and the gray area of relationships is amazing, insofar as you see this abusive father who also shows a certain degree of tenderness for his kids, and then you also have his kids openly wish they could kill him.
Yeah.
Often to his, you know, and they say that to him, but then when he's gone, they cry, or at least one daughter cries and says, I want him, like, I want him back. And it's like, that is so difficult to watch. It'd be so much easier if he was just totally a monster and they completely hated him, you know? And so, but then also, on top of everything else, because this is not focused on any one character, which could actually leave you at arm's length from the situation, the way he shoots it, the type of dialogue he writes, the way he orchestrates the actors, you're not focused on one character. You actually, or at least I did, I felt like I was another member of the family, and I was watching this the same way they were. On edge, always waiting for something bad to happen, being grateful when it doesn't, and then on top of everything else, so on Twitter, I've been doing this thing where, like, I follow movie accounts that do, like, these prompts like, you know, what's the scariest movie moment you've ever seen, or best performance by a pair of sunglasses, or something like that. And one was, this is a while back, one was, what's a movie that shows the power of music? And I, you know, people were saying, like, Amadeus and all that. I chose to say Shine. But that was before I watched these movies, because I could easily say the filmography of Terrence Davies. Like, you see how vital music is in these characters' lives, but not as, like, people that want to make music, but just as an escape, as a way of being part of a community, solidarity, bravery. So it's just, he manages to do all of these things effortlessly, and I'm just, while also creating beautiful frames and tableaus, and I'm just, it's just astonishing to me. I love it so much.
Yeah, I mean,
sorry I said all that.
No, I'm glad you did, because I struggled a bit more with these first two films, and I figured you guys would have liked them more, and I'm glad that you had more to say about them, and I also just didn't dislike them outright, so it's nothing I really want to, like, get into it about, but I had a harder time connecting, I think. Part of that is I just tend not to like films about children that much, but that's my own personal limitation.
But I mean, the second half of the movie, they're all grown
no
up.
I know,
and for a certain, for a significant portion of the first half as well.
Yeah, they grow up earlier than I.
Well, I mean, like, we do see, like, funeral stuff, like, right. They are older,
right?
And then there, from what I, so there was like a two-year gap between shooting
the production
first
movie,
half,
yeah,
and then the second half. So they are noticeably older in the second half.
Yeah.
But we do see moments of them being adults in the first half.
Okay. This is because I watched these chronologically. It's been the longest since I've seen these early ones. And then so he follows that up with The Long Day Closes, which...
what do you have to say about this one? Did you like it?
Yeah, I loved it. I guess I liked The Long Day Closes even more.
Yeah, so did I.
Although I'm sure Scott hated it because it's about a boy.
No, it's a more elegant film, so it goes down smooth. Yeah. It's just, both times I saw it, by the end of it, I was just like, okay, I like it, but it's not. And I think there's also something about pure memory films. I think a lot of what the texture he builds into these films is better utilized later on.
Long Day Closes is, having now seen everything, if someone going to ask me for an entry point to Terrence Davies, I think I would recommend Long Day Closes, presuming you like coming of age movies. But so here you've got the Terrence Davies surrogate is a young boy again who is... among other things, obsessed with going to the movies, which really obviously speaks to people like us. It also,
and it's not super obvious about it.
Yeah, it's not like it's not like Cinema Paradiso, which I always use as the like bad example, an example of a bad movie that's about the magic of movies. I know a lot of people like Cinema Paradiso, but I don't.
I still haven't seen it.
I've never seen it.
Yeah, it's not worth your time.
You should come over and we'll watch it together.
All right, perfect.
just a stray observation about Long Day Closes, or just about like British life in general. Like, it rains very rarely in Los Angeles, so when it rains, it's a big deal.
Yeah.
But when I watch like British, like a Tyler and I are both fans of Taskmaster, the British like comedy reality competition show, and often it'll just be raining during one of the tasks, and they just go about it. Yeah. Like when it rains, when a place where it rains a lot, you just go about your day when it's raining. And I remember thinking like there's like a part early on in the movie where he's just like going to the movies and it's just pouring out, and I was like, yeah, I guess you got to just do that. You can't like. You can't be like Newman and say like, "Oh, I don't work when it rains."
Yeah. I'm not really one for creeds.
Yeah, that's right.
It's interesting. I feel like I would say this is an entry point for a certain type of person, because it is, I think, in many ways, it's shot in a straightforward way, but narratively, I'd say it's almost experimental. Just the way that there is no, like, this is not told in order of story. It seemed to jump back and forth a lot. And I say jump, but it certainly doesn't feel like that. It's more like this swirling experience of childhood. But as a result, I could see someone watching this and getting very frustrated wondering, quote unquote, when it's when the movie's gonna start. So yeah, I'm not sure. I would say this is a, I mean, I adore it. It's probably my favorite of the ones I saw, but man, that's tough. I love them all.
Well,
but,
look, but yeah, you're probably right. As I said on a recent Patreon, sign up at patreon.com/battleshipretention. Despite being someone who calls myself a film critic, I am very bad at knowing what people like about movies and why. So maybe it would be a bad entry point, but it would have been a great entry point for me.
I think for our listeners, if you haven't seen any Terrence Davies, I do think for our listeners, this is a great entry point.
It also has a lot more of those group sing-alongs. Yeah. I love the neighbor lady with the drunken husband.
Oh my.
I was going to bring that up actually.
I love her.
It's an interesting bit of texture because it's like so funny for a lot of it. And then becomes kind of sad towards the end of the last few scenes they're in.
Yeah. And she's like walking him home. And
And it kind of speaks like Distant Voice is a lot more aggressive about like the abuse environment that were very common in this era.
Yeah.
But just kind of a general tone of cruelty. That's like, everyone kind of puts up with and is kind of amused by to a point.
Yeah, that's a good point, because going all the way back to children, you get the kids being cruel. There is a lot of cruelty in these early movies. This one also has, if I'm remembering correctly, and they're not bleeding together, not only does it have music, but it has a lot of like, you hear dialogue from movies, even in scenes when he's not watching the movies. I'm trying to remember what movies, because I know I recognize at least one of the
Lady Killers.
Okay.
Like, the first one we hear is from the Lady Killers, where Alec Guinness says, "I understand you have rooms to let."
Mm-hmm.
And that's as they're setting up this boarding house situation.
Right, right. Yeah, there are definitely other ones that I recognized, or at least one other that I recognized, but I can't remember what they were.
Yeah, Amberson's.
Amberson's is all over it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because he's it's Orson Welles talking about like men's fashion, like that.
Yeah.
Like the opening, like 5-10 minutes of many of his Amberson's are among my favorite 5-10 minutes of cinema ever.
Yeah.
So I love that. Any other thoughts on The Long Day Closes before we move into kind of a new stage of his career?
Yeah, I think it's worth noting quickly on Long Day Closes that this was kind of the period that he identifies his life as the happiest, which is interesting. His age is from like right after his father died to when puberty onset, and like then he became more troubled by his sexuality.
Yeah.
When he could just kind of live in this kind of blissful, you know, movie-filled family environment. Mm. And I think the film captures that without being overly sentimental about it. Like I said, you get kind of that texture of unhappiness of like, this was the post-war years. I mean, he was born in like 1945, so it was like immediately into an environment where, people were glad to be done with the war, but they were also dealing with a lot of grief that they didn't really have the words for. And I think the film captures that really well.
You do start to see in this film the early onset of his sexuality.
Yeah, like, for sure. Like, there's traces there.
Absolutely.
His next film, 1995's The Neon Bible, is not technically autobiographical because it's an adaptation of a novel, but it's interesting.
But in broad strokes, you would almost think it would be.
Yeah, dovetailing off of what Scott said about being happy up until puberty, this is a teenage boy at a very unhappy.
abusive father.
Yeah, years of his life. I will say off the top, right off the bat, though, this is my least favorite of his
films. I think it's everybody's.
It just feels like, and he made at least three films that were set in America. This is the first one, and it feels like he's trying to just like lift his view of mid-century England and drop it wholesale into the 1940s American rural South, and it doesn't fit.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other ones fit better because they're kind of in the northeastern area where they inherited and brought over a lot of English customs.
Yeah.
But yeah, to just drop it into the South, and it doesn't help that like the novel it's based on, I can't remember the writer's name, but the same guy who did Confederacy of Dunces, and he killed himself before his novels were ever published, and like.
It's John Kennedy Toole.
Yeah. But so this one he wrote when he was like 16 years old. And you can kind of see like it not only has the lack of general perspective and slight immaturity of that, and it just like feels like every staple of like Southern Gothic literature is just like thrown into this book. But it also has the feeling that you have when you're 16 of like life stops at 16, you know, it like, it really can't see beyond that in a lot of ways. And I think he's just kind of hemmed in by that and by his own lack of perspective. I mean, it does have Gina Rounds in it, so it has at least one very good performance.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's just a, and it's his first attempt at a real narrative structure, even though it kind of has like the tapestry of a memory film. So yeah, it just kind of doesn't work in a lot of ways.
The abusive father is played by Dennis Leary.
Yeah.
And it just reminded me of like, there was a time that Dennis Leary was just regularly in movies as an actor. And then I feel like he like, I don't think it was his stand up so much as he became like a television auteur, I think.
Sure.
Yeah.
With like first The Job and then Rescue Me and then the one that everyone forgets about that's called like Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, I think, something like that.
I don't remember.
It was very short lived. But I think he became too like attached to his own like projects where he was the lead that like he no longer seemed to fit as a character actor. But he used to be in movies all the time.
Yeah.
And he's not, I don't think he's bad here, but I also just don't think he's, I don't know if it's him or if, like I said, just the rural South, just the nature of Terrence Davies' dialogue just feels like it doesn't quite fit.
Does in, he do his mouth. Does he do an accent?
He's doing a Southern accent, right?
Yeah, is that of a sort.
Yeah,
yeah.
By way of Boston.
Yeah,
but I mean, I guess minor spoilers. Like Pete Postlethwaite weight and Distant Voices Still Lives. He's not in the whole movie,
right?
Yeah, I'm glad I watched it, and the best scenes are the group sing-alongs. There's a beautiful scene where they're walking to a tent revival church thing.
Yeah.
And they're singing on the way to the church and the camera is overhead on this small street. And then you get into the church where people are like sitting in built like rafters and the camera is like behind the preacher, I guess. And you're seeing this like beautifully symmetrical just rows of people in this like candlelit tent at night. It's very cool.
Yeah, I mean, it has incredible moments to it. Terrence Davis can't help but it. But I do think he runs up against trying to build those into a narrative structure that I think he gets more successful at with his next film.
Okay,
I'm definitely. I didn't see that one, but I'm definitely interested. At the very least, I just love the idea of someone being like, you know, it would be perfect for this Terrence Davies film. Dennis Leary. or maybe Dan Aykroyd.
Yeah, well, that gets into
the difference is Dan Aykroyd's really good in House of Mirth, if you ask me.
He really is.
But it's, I mean, the House of Mirth has like very sideways casting. Like very few of these people you would think of for these roles.
Yeah.
So let's move into the House of Mirth, and I'm gonna start by saying that I think Tyler had the same problem. I had a hurdle to enjoying this movie.
Yeah.
Because the transfer that is on Paramount Plus with Showtime looks like absolute shit.
Oh, that's too bad.
It looks like
effort into it.
It looks like a rip from a PAL DVD. Like it has it, and I wonder if like I probably would have liked the movie more if I saw it the way it's supposed to look.
Yeah,
because that really did hinder my enjoyment. That it looks so bad.
Like it looked like it was a 90s TV movie.
Well, like a 90s BBC TV.
I'm very glad I made it to the Los Feliz 3's screening on 35mm because it actually, in actuality, looks incredible.
Okay, good, good. Well, you guys both saw this one, so did I, but Scott, it sounded like you had something to say.
Oh, no, I mean, just by way of like introducing the general tapestry. So it's based on a novel by Edith Wharton, who also wrote, if I'm not mistaken, The Age of Innocence, right?
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Which had come out a few years before, and this was kind of like the last gasp of that real like post Merchant Ivory era of just like very elaborate costume dramas being like kind of guaranteed films to find purchase at the American box office. And so this was kind of operating in that tradition, and it, for whatever reason, didn't get that kind of reception that a lot of those films did. I think part of it stems from casting Gillian Anderson in the lead role as Lily Bart. Who she's like this socialite who is unmarried, not really having any purpose in her life or any direction, very bad with money, and gradually over the course of the film sees her options to achieve and maintain status in society narrow as she passes over marriage proposals, pursues marriages that never come to fruition, and her family support system kind of gradually crumbles. And it's kind of that very archetypal structure for an Edith Wharton type of story.
Yeah.
And this is one of the next American set films that takes place in New York at the turn of the century, which is established by a title card at the very end that I don't know about you, is devastating.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is about it, but like just dropping, finally setting it in a time and a place. I don't know. It had an overwhelming effect on me.
I totally agree with you. And I can't totally figure out why.
I know. I've been thinking about it for months now.
It's like I just had the thought of maybe like, because maybe like, it's more recent than it feels
maybe,
like it should
yeah.
be. You're like, holy shit, this is in America as recently as the 1900s?
Or
like,
it almost shit, man. Kind of functions as like an obituary, maybe?
Kind of. Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
But yeah, it's... so yeah, she... Gillian Anderson plays the main role. Gillian Anderson, rather. And then Eric Stoltz is kind of like the fashionable dandy that she's pursuing. Yeah. I was listening to an episode of This Had Oscar Buzz that they covered this episode, and that's hosted by two gay men, and they're like, is Eric Stoltz gay code in this, or is he just thin and pale and fancy? And I think he's just thin and pale and fancy.
Yeah. I think he's, I could see him being described as kind of a cad
yeah.
in some ways.
But he's also kind of the most earnest towards her
yeah.
and generally wants her happiness, but also isn't able to, because at the beginning he doesn't really have enough money for the two of them to get married, even though they're in love. And she's kind of like, in a way, kind of positing herself as too good for him in the way that she posits herself as too good for anyone that she encounters. Yeah. So the two of them are kind of the emotional core, but then Dan Aykroyd is another kind of suitor of hers who, yeah, is more trying to just take advantage of her situation, loaning yeah. her money and expecting a certain type of repayment.
Yeah.
And then Anthony LaPaglia, who is the most kind of like viable suitor for her, but the least desirable, until yeah. he becomes her only option too late in the film. Yeah.
He is, I think eventually like, pretty sympathetic towards her.
Oh, for sure. But he's also very clear about his own boundaries yeah. of like, she's gotten herself into a social position where if he takes on that kind of social debt,
yeah.
will become more than he can bear despite yeah. his attraction to her. Yeah. The kind of most straightforward casting is Laura Linney as her kind of like friend slash enemy yeah. in that very kind of like,
if only there was a term for that.
Yeah, yeah. No, right. And she's amazing, of course.
Of course.
But the film really, I think, does a good job of establishing the severity of these kind of social norms. I think the easy way out of this kind of genre is to be like, oh, haha, these foolish people
yeah.
giving into these strict societal rules. But like, when you get to that scene of her in Dan Aykroyd's house and he kind of brought her over yeah. under the auspices of spending time with his wife. And yeah. then he's like, oh, my wife is upstairs. And then she finds out his wife isn't there at all.
Yeah.
And she's terrified to find out that she's alone in the house with this guy.
Yeah.
Not only for what he could do to her physically, but for what it could mean to her reputation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Dan Aykroyd's great in that scene. He was also just a few years later in Stephen Fry's Bright Young Things, which is an adaptation of Evelyn Waugh's Vile Bodies, which is a great novel that I've read. That's, and it's weird that he did these, like, within 3 years, he did these two sort of, like, early 20s, late
yeah.
late 19th, early 20th century period pieces. He was great in both of them.
And let's not just, forget like, Evolution.
Of course. Yeah.
Evolution as well.
But then he just was like, I'm done with that kind of acting, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's too bad, because he's really great in this movie, and really terrifying in that particular scene. I hope to get a chance someday to see this movie again the way
yeah.
it's meant to look, because it was a distraction to me. And I think because there's something very straightforward about his dialogue and the way he directs actors to deliver his dialogue.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how much presentation can make something go from looking austere to looking cheap.
Yeah, yeah. For sure.
And the movie kind of like felt cheap because it looked so shitty on Paramount Plus.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. It really was a bummer because I really love the movie. And I like that he just like throws you in like right
yeah.
in the middle. Like there's no real beginning. It's like all of the relationships have already started. And
yeah.
he doesn't like write dialogue to like catch you up.
Right.
And that first scene between her and Stoltz, like, it's weird to describe something like that as riveting, but just their little back and forth and the looks they give each other is just like, you don't need an introduction. It's just so laden with meaning. And what's funny is that we were talking about, like, the role of music in his films. This one has almost none.
Yeah.
Well, certainly, I don't think anybody sings in it.
These aren't the singing people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, if you look at his filmography, I think that's notable.
Yeah.
Like, the way he's like, yeah, I'm not going to put this hallmark of my career. Yeah. I'm not going to put that in here. Because these are not, because that, you know, he uses music to show senses of unity mm-hmm. and community. And it's like, that's not how these people operate. There is no unity. There is no community. It's kind of everybody for themselves.
Yeah.
But they're very dignified about it.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, a lot of what's interesting about the last half of his career is, in those last four films, is that he takes kind of either books or people's lives and kind of folds them into making a sort of autobiographical thing where they are as much about him as they are about the thing.
Yeah.
This is probably the most straightforward adaptation he did in really trying to service the material. And yeah, it just, it didn't really catch on with critics or box office or awards. Maybe partially because Julianne Anders was so associated with The X-Files that people just had such a hard time associating her in this kind of environment.
Yeah.
But it really kind of damaged his career. I mean, from this point, he tries to get an adaptation of Sunset Song off the ground with Kirsten Dunst. That doesn't happen. He later ends up making Sunset Song with a different cast. But he just, like, made so many attempts in this period to try to get something going. And the only thing he could was a documentary.
Yeah, so that's... Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, like, I don't mean to be a film Twitter basic, but I hope that, like, Criterion snaps up this movie.
I know, same.
So that it gets a good transfer.
Yeah.
At
yeah.
the very least.
Yeah.
And it'll get people, it'll get eyeballs on it.
Yeah.
Because.
I mean, it sounds like there's a good element out there that you saw.
I mean, there's yeah. a print. Yeah. I'm yeah. sure there's, the. I'm sure the negative still exists
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
And the Gillian Anderson thing, like, since then, she's acted in all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, and now so she's like a renowned theater actress. I think
yeah.
now there's more openness to her.
Yeah, kind
of so like, I didn't even think about that.
Watching it now, I didn't even think about it.
Yeah,
I didn't totally. Question it.
Yeah.
But then I went back and looked at reviews,
yeah.
and I was like, wow, they're really hung up on The X-Files. And I realized, like, oh yeah, I guess that's kind of... Wow. All she was known for.
I didn't even think
well,
that.
Yeah. I mean, at the time, like, you know, The Sopranos had just debuted the year before. You know,
yeah.
TV was still a very disreputable yeah. medium, and especially genre TV.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you mentioned a documentary that he made 8 years later. So this is kind of his most fallow period.
Yeah.
8 years later, he made an autobiographical sort of collage documentary called Of Time in the City. Which I just recently saw, I don't know how you say his name, Clay Burman, Denzo Filho's Pictures of Ghosts.
His
new film, which is a very similar, like, autobiographical documentary. The main thing I think that stuck out to me about Of Time in the City is going like, oh, Terrence Davies does have a sense of humor. Because there's not a lot of comedy in his films, but his voiceover the documentary is often, like, quite wry and funny.
I think you get a bit of the humor in House of Mirth, in those, especially the early scenes. And I think, I mean, after Deep Blue Sea, there's an element of cleverness to all of his films. But yeah, the best thing about Of Time in the City to me was hearing his voice, which is so rich and, like, deep and baritone, and then kind of mixed with very kind of wry observations about the period.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's pretty easy to find, right?
Yeah.
I mean, all of these movies are available many streaming, sometimes some of them you have to rent, and some people it's a huge hurdle for some reason.
I know.
I don't get that. But, Of Time in the City is very, very good, and also it's 72 minutes.
Yeah.
So make time for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then we move into the second full period of his career, starting with 2011's The Deep Blue Sea, the first of his movies that I ever saw. which means it's also the one that it's been the longest since I've seen. I haven't seen it since... It probably came out in the U.S. in 2012.
Yeah. It was an early 2012 release.
Yeah, 2012 is when I saw it. And I feel like it was still... I mean, that was when Tom Hiddleston was, like, hot shit. Like,
yeah.
Right? Because
this was a big,
like,
period for him.
Because it seemed like I went from not knowing who Tom Hiddleston was to, like, him being in, like, five movies a year.
Yeah.
With, like, there was, like, this and War Horse and... I'm trying to remember what the other things were leading up to the Avengers that I would have seen.
Well, there was the first... Well, did you see the first Thor?
Oh, I did see the first.
Okay, yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
And
that's
then also High Rise.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I'm not saying all these were good movies.
High Rise isn't...
It's awful. Fine.
Yeah, but... yeah, now it's sad that, like, he's just Loki now.
I know.
Yeah. He was such an exciting actor for a short time there. The Hank Williams biopic, notwithstanding, what a boring piece of garbage.
That thing came and went.
Yeah, The Deep Blue Sea is. I mean, we're talking about Tom Hiddleston, but really, this is Rachel Weisz's movie.
Yeah,
more so. She's the lead. Did you watch this one?
Yeah, I watched it last night.
Okay, well then, yeah, recently than I have.
And I would say that Tom Hiddleston, at least for me, is like the third lead.
Yeah.
Behind Simon Russell Beale.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I like I said, like I was saying earlier, I eventually found my way to finding this movie very moving. But I've been a Rachel Weisz fan. I mean, I've had a crush on her at least since The Mummy, probably.
Sure.
And then Constantine. Like, she's... Maybe she's one of my favorite actresses, and this is a great performance. But also, as someone who, like, loves her so much, I'll often, like, hard to watch her, like, continue to make these poor decisions for herself in favor of this guy. What were you going to say?
Oh, just yeah, like I feel like again, of course, I haven't seen. It's the latest film of his that I've seen. So I really don't know as far as his entire filmography. But I think this is a good entry point.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes, it does have flashbacks and jumps around in time. But it is more dialogue driven. It is more narrative driven. The relationships are a little bit more straightforward. Probably because it's based on a play. So I feel like this is one that, like, if you're like wary for some reason of getting into his filmography, I feel like this one is accessible enough so that you can follow and enjoy it, but still has plenty of his hallmarks,
including, like I said, it's been 12 years since I've seen it, but I have distinct memories of the sequence when everyone's hiding in the subway
during the
bombing and the cameras tracking along these people, and it's another, like, sing-along type of but very obviously not a happy one.
And to blend that basically with her like wanting to kill herself.
Yeah,
like she goes wanting to jump in front of a train, and then of course we wind up there, and then she doesn't kill herself, and you kind of wonder, it's like, oh, these probably are related. Like, in both cases, she almost died, but very different circumstances.
Yeah, so this is an adaptation of a Terence Rattigan play. Terence Rattigan was also gay, and the play was in part about a homosexual relationship that he had, that he almost wrote the play directly about that, but ended up kind of queer coding it instead.
Sure.
And the film was actually commissioned by, like, his estate or something like that. And whoever produced this film thought of Terrence Davies IV. That's the entire reason he had to come back. This wasn't something that Davies was pursuing, but the producer saw this material and was like, you know who I think would be good for this? And I think he's quite right, because he brings all of that texture from, like, The Long Day Closes and that sense of kind of post-war life into this, which all of these next few films are about people who are one way or another marked by a war. In this case, it's World War II. It takes place, the opening title card says about 1950.
Around 1950,
which I really love.
I love that, yeah.
Both the opening and closing shots are kind of mirrors of each other in very much establishing that sense of like post-war life, that there's, that all these people are in some way haunted by the war, and you know, her kind of remembering this moment of hiding in the Blitz is a good example of this, of like, there was this, she goes down there to kill herself and remembers this moment where she could have died at like literally any moment. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, that like, there were bomb shelters during the Blitz, but like, if that bomb's coming on down on top of you, that's no saving you. And so all you could do is kind of cling to somebody close to you. Maybe someone could get a sing-along going. And that scene's interesting too, because she's kind of singing along and kind of not.
Right.
And both of the sing-along scenes she's part of have that thing of like, she's somewhat participating but somewhat not.
And
the way that she's like somewhat a part of the society and even somewhat a part of her life and also standing somewhat outside of it. And then Tom Hiddleston plays this like kind of hotshot pilot who, you know, was one of those guys who had a great war career. And you hear about this with World War One too, where like there's these incredible ace pilots who, you know, shot down tons of enemy planes, and then they get back and they have like nothing to live for. And so he's happy to kind of seduce and destroy this beautiful woman who's willing to do anything for him. And including sacrificing all of herself, but gives almost nothing of himself over. And
admits it.
Both know the deal. And for a film based on a play, it has none of that kind of staginess. There's
not
like
at all.
Maybe one extended scene. I don't have a problem with that. Like, I like very stagey films, but right away you're plunged into kind of these overlapping bits of memory and flashback that all kind of feel like interspersed with one another, to an extent that like you could almost read stuff that happens after the opening as just like her kind of like life flashing before her eyes, like as she's dying, until you find out that her suicide attempt was unsuccessful, and kind of like pitifully so. There's a scene where they kind of like recap her attempt, and like she took like, enough to knock herself out, but
like
she was
12 aspirin.
Really that much in danger. But yeah, Rachel Weisz is incredible in the film. And it is interesting that this came out the same year as Anna Karenina, the Joe Wright's adaptation, because they're both about women who give up their kind of positions in society for men who really don't care for them. And the two films were compared a lot. They're both visually extravagant experiences to different degrees. I've come to think that this is maybe a little bit more of the refined film, as much as I adore Anna Karenina.
I think Anna Karenina, like, there's certainly a lot more flourish to it.
Yeah.
Whereas this one is a bit more subdued.
Yeah. I mean, it has like the Terrence Davies kind of flourishes of like the long track of shots. I mean, the whole scene in the tunnel is a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
And that cut to her, like the train passing by her and her hair kind of like fluttering up is far and away my favorite shot in any of his films. Breathtaking.
It is pretty great.
I was just going to say, I don't like Anna Karenina as much as you guys, because especially at that period of Joe Wright, I don't like more like Joe Wrong. I don't like
you're missing out.
I mean, I wasn't a huge fan of Atonement,
but I like Darkest Hour and Cyrano.
I adore Cyrano. I didn't love Darkest Hour,
same,
but I really loved Anna Karenina. And I will say, like, it is a shame, like you were saying, it's a shame that Tom Hiddleston is just Loki now. Because you see what he does in this film, and you realize, like, the kind of potential he has that is being, I would say, it's not, I mean, he's great as Loki, obviously, but he's not living up to his full acting potential. Whereas here, he can be tremendously charming, and then also, like, you know, the character is basically, like, the personification of passion, and that passion is like, you know, lustful and also angry and bitter and unreliable, and he's all of those things, and he's those things feasibly. Like, it's not like when one thing happens it doesn't fit with the other things, like he brings all of them together in one complete character. And I did love Simon Russell Beale as well, because this character is not just like the clueless, stuffy, unloving husband. I mean, he's very loving. Obviously, like, there's some societal stuff, like with his mom.
Yeah, terrible mother.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. But like, you can just see the way he looks at her, like, this is not an abusive husband. It is not it's not an unloving husband. And it's one of those things, like, he's so loving that he's willing to, like, forgive her and, I mean, after a while, and help her.
Yeah.
So, like, in a way, he is for her what she is for Tom Hiddleston.
Yeah, but I think he also, and what both of them recognize, is that there's a limitation to how he can express his love. Yes. And you see that totally with his upbringing. You, like, in the brief scenes with his mother, you get a very clear sense of where this guy's coming from. And, like, he's always going to be able to give his tenderness to her, but never give any sense of passion to her. Because he just doesn't have it in him.
Yeah, and I mean, the film is obviously just... The story itself is just an inherent tragedy.
Yeah.
For all three characters. Because Tom Hiddleston absolutely recognizes that he can't give the tenderness and devotion that people need. And so it's, all three characters are very self-aware.
Yeah.
But they also feel like there's nothing I can do about it.
Yeah, big time.
So there's a certain fatalism to it, I think.
The last thing I want to say about the film is just slightly building on that fatalism is Terrence Davies didn't do a lot of sex scenes, but there's a kind of brief one in here that is at once very hot, but also like the both their bodies are so pale, and I think it's like a thing of lighting or color timing that like it almost feels like they're dead already. It's like very haunting.
Wow. Maybe Tom Hiddleston was already getting ready for Only Lovers Left Alive.
Yeah, there right.
By the way, before we move on, just... I mean, I know streaming shows don't really exist, but Apple TV is a real black hole, because I was looking up what was the last thing that Tom Hiddleston did that wasn't Loki. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, he did a 6-episode miniseries with Claire Danes on Apple TV, all episodes directed by Cleo Bernard, who made The Arbor and The Selfish Giant. Insane that I never heard about that. Two great actors, also Clement Posey and Haley. Oh, it's called The Essex Serpent.
Oh, I've heard of that.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know anything about it, and I didn't watch it, but Apple TV Plus, in general, is a black hole. Yeah. And I think probably because it has maybe the worst user interface.
It's pretty bad.
Like, it makes Prime Video look like fucking Netflix.
All right, well, let's move on to Sunset Song, which I loved.
Big fan.
You didn't see this one?
This is where my contribution will end.
Okay.
So I'm going to take a nap.
Try not to snore into the microphone. Sunset Song 2015, starring a woman whose name is Agnes Dane.
Yeah, she's mainly a model.
Yeah, she's the Scottish Olivia Thirlby. She looks so much like Olivia Thirlby.
I can see that.
I actually I checked IMDb to make sure it was Olivia Thirlby doing a Scottish accent. This is again early 1900s, but feels older in many ways because it's rural Scotland.
Talk
about his penchant for like depicting a cruelty in just a terrible world.
Yeah, the first like half hour or so of this movie is real rough.
Yeah, I mean, her father is played by Peter Mullen, a great Scottish actor who has a long history of playing pieces of shit. Seems to be his forte and doesn't depart from that.
I'll say this. I did not really like Ozark. But he's on it, and he's great.
Yeah, I didn't watch it. A lot of, like Scott was saying, a lot of bad stuff happens to this young woman. Chris Guthrie is the character, including, I mean, there's like the most awful thing imaginable happens just off screen.
Yeah.
It's like just referenced. But I don't know. This isn't like a complaint so much as just an observation. Because I think Agnes Dane is great. This has nothing to do with her. But after watching House of Mirth and then The Deep Blue Sea, which I didn't rewatch, but like in that order, I think Chris as a protagonist is maybe a bit less interestingly flawed than the last two women. Like, it feels like Chris is mostly something that things happen to for most of the movie.
Yeah, but like, she's the only one of her entire family who stays with it. And I think there's something right. about like her willingness or ability to withstand so much that does point to a kind of like, I don't know if you'd call it a flaw, but it's a certain like trait. And especially by the end where she's lost all the people who mattered to her, all of whom have treated her poorly, but she's still very sad that they're gone. It kind of points back to the thing you guys were talking about, Disney Voices Still Lives. It's like, regardless of how fraught those relationships are, they do still inform your life. And Davies is a mature enough filmmaker to not like just like excuse all that and just make it sentimental, but still acknowledge it, you know?
Yeah.
And the film, it can be, I mean, it's a hard watch for sure, but it can be terribly sweet at times too. Like,
it's just, and it's also just beautiful.
Yeah.
The Scottish countryside and everything. Like, yeah, I would not, I would happily watch this movie again.
And there's a good long stretch of it where it seems like her life is going to work out.
Which makes it all sour, of course. So sad.
I guess I'm just saying like it isn't relentless misery for so long. Strange fact about this film is that when it came out, it was released in simultaneous like regular versions and with subtitles, even though it's in English, because the Scottish accents were so thick.
I think the wherever I watched it, it was subtitled.
Oh, really?
I don't know that I needed it.
Yeah, I've never needed it.
It's a cliche at this point that it's hard to make an anti-war movie because depicting war,
right?
Blah, blah, blah. This movie doesn't depict the war. That's the way around it. It ends up being, I think, a very fervently anti-war movie by just depicting what it does to the home front and also what it does to
the people
a soldier
who go
when
off.
he comes back. But even before her husband comes back and is a changed man, the attitudes of the people in town. There's a scene where the priest played by an actor named Mark Bonner who was on Catastrophe, the Amazon series with Rob Delaney and Sharon Horgan. Very good show. Where he's like using his literal pulpit to like, he's not really doing a sermon. He's basically just saying like any able-bodied man who doesn't sign up for the war is a coward.
Yeah.
And a pro-German coward at that. It becomes vicious the way that the townspeople treat one another.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah, very great, depressing movie. I liked it a lot.
Hell yeah.
And then, in short, I mean...
Yeah, the quickest turnaround in his career.
Just the next year, he made what I would consider the best of his American set films.
Okay.
A Quiet Passion, where the great Cynthia Nixon plays Emily Dickinson.
Yeah.
And I guess he sort of ended his career with two movies about poets.
Yeah. That, again, I think these are the ones where he really followed the autobiography and as much as he's making about them.
Yeah.
Because Emily Dickinson's life lends itself to a lot of different facets that intersect with his, where, like, she didn't have any romantic relationships. She kind of led a cloistered life and her work wasn't celebrated in the course of her career. And like, she has that great line. There was a great exchange with a priest at one point where it comes around to saying like, it would be nice to get some acknowledgement while I'm alive. And like, she really talks about like the fact that, it's great to have a posthumous legacy and all that, but it gives a sense that Terrence Davis knew that about himself too, that like, he knew his films would last because by this point, The Long Day Closes was a celebrated classic, but it wasn't doing him any good in the present,
This is also, I credit both Terrence Davies and Cynthia Nixon with that. You were saying, we were talking about of Time in the City, that there's more humor in his later films.
Yeah.
And this I think
so is funny.
This is the funniest of his non-documentary.
Well, because she has a great best friend who's just like so dismissive of everything.
Yeah.
And kind of inspires Emily Dickinson to like be a little more dismissive than even she will be.
Yeah, and like buck expectations.
Yeah.
And, yeah. But also, you mentioned the priest who appreciates her work, but his wife is the biggest stick in the mud, maybe in cinematic history.
And Emily leaving her sister alone with the wife at the one scene, and her sister's like giving her the face to be like,
yeah. But this woman, she abstains not just from alcohol, but basically anything, but
including lemonade.
Water.
Yeah. Basically, like anything that gives joy is against the Lord.
Yeah.
So great.
But yeah, fantastic performance from Cynthia Nixon, whom I always think of because I obviously she's most associated with Miranda from Sex and the City. The I'm a Miranda, so I've always identified with Miranda, but also I know her as Katie Purnell from Hannibal, and I feel like she has this carriage where she usually seems in charge.
Right.
And her Emily Dickinson is often so, like, she's iconoclastic, but she's also vulnerable and unsure of herself, and in many ways she's so protected that she remains girlish late into her middle age. It's a fantastic performance.
Yeah, and there's that great exchange kind of... we come around to understand that she wrote like in the early morning hours when no one else was awake, and at one point her sister-in-law, who lives in like the house next door, sees that the light's on. They come over and like have a chat, and Emily Dickinson talks about like the way she's kind of built her life and the things that she doesn't have, and you know, her sister-in-law is kind of admiring her for like her rigor and her prolific output despite the poems not really catching on. And Emily Dickinson has a line where she's like, yeah, first you deceive yourself and then you deceive others into thinking that like this is enough for her. And that's another part that seemed very like autobiographical for Davies himself.
Yeah.
It's a very, very good movie. I was really glad that I revisited it.
I had not seen it until two nights ago. And again, in this long history of... not quite sympathetic fathers.
Yeah.
You've got Keith Carradine here.
He's hardly like the most abusive.
He's not Pete Possibly, but yeah. He
really carves out the chance for her to like flourish as an artist, which I think is like an interesting way the film deals with gender roles, because there's a lot in the film about how narrow her options are as a woman. But also like she also had the ability to stay at home through most of her life. Like, for a man, they would be kicked out of the house and like made to have a career and marry and all that. You know, a man couldn't build the same kind of career at this time. And career is even too small a word, because like she wasn't bringing any money on it, but build a life around essentially their like hobby, you know?
Yeah. Other actors, the sister you mentioned is played by Jennifer L, E-H-L-E. She's
been in
a ton of stuff.
Yeah. I was more talking about her sister-in-law, but yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But yes, Jennifer. But the one she leaves with the stick in the mud is
that's
Jennifer
true. Yeah, that's
right?
Her sister.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. So she's been in a bunch of stuff. If you don't know who she is, and then an actor I didn't know plays her brother Austin. Duncan Duff is his name, and I thought he was fantastic as well.
Yeah, he's fantastic. Looking at his wiki page, it seems like he's a Scottish actor and mainly kind of sticks to his part of the world.
We just got done talking about Sunset Song and the onset of World War I.
This takes place kind of alongside the Civil War.
The Civil War breaks out at one point, and there's an argument between her brother and her father about joining up. The brother wants to join up, fight for his country against the South, and Keith Carradine says, no, we're going to pay the $500 for someone to go in your place. And it's just, I talked about Emily being remaining kind of girlish into her middle age, but also like her brother by this point, like he doesn't look like a kid. He's a man.
Yeah.
And the way he is just like told what to do and cowed and put in his place by Keith Carradine, I felt bad for him.
Yeah, but Keith Carradine's kind of right. I mean, like at that point, he's about to be a new father. He's starting his family out. I don't know that going off to war and dying is the best route for him.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't work in Sunset Song.
Exactly.
Also, like, what are people going to think of him? That's a big motivating factor as well.
Yeah, and that's like one of the huge things throughout Davey's career, and which I kind of meant to mention at the top, but like, and I guess I mentioned throughout the episode, but just the way in which people are shaped by the society around them and not diminishing that. And I think that's something that modern viewers tend to like look down on and not recognize the ways in which society shapes all of us, and that there are all these still extant rules of society that we all kind of unconsciously behave around. So I don't think these things are as distant as people make them out to be.
Or as what?
Are as distant as people make them out to be. The idea of societal rules kind of like being over, like we've conquered them.
No, yeah. I mean, I like I said, I very much sympathized with Austin and the pressures that he felt to go off to war.
Yeah.
And also just because I have a hang up about being made to feel or appeal or appear like a child, I would have hated to be my age and have a father tell me I couldn't go do something. All right, so that brings us to, sadly, the final film.
Yeah.
Benediction, which came out, I guess, came out in the U.S. in 2021, I think?
Yeah.
No, 2022.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, so I guess, but it was a 2020.
I'm seeing it as 2021.
Oh, okay. I believe you.
It looks like it premiered at TIFF that in 2021.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, and so this returns us to the... what's the word I'm looking for? That fucking leaf blower, like...
It's really messing with your mind.
Threw my vocabulary away.
Yeah.
The overtly gay characters. Overtly was not the word I'm looking for, but this is a biopic of the British poet Siegfried Sassoon.
Yep.
Who, unlike Emily Dickinson, I will admit, I did not know who Siegfried Sassoon was before.
Same. Yeah.
I saw Benediction. Anyway, I just talked about it. What do you have to say?
Oh God, I'll have a bad introduction to this because I didn't get a chance to revisit this in full. But essentially, it's about.
I was hoping you did because I didn't either. Since 2022. But
it's about Sassoon's kind of life and career after World War I, where he comes back, does not want to reenlist, and really becomes an opponent of the war because of the scars it's leaving. You know, I mean, World War I was famous for just like relentlessly sending people in to die. Like there's occasionally a strategy in play, but most of the time people were just being sent pointlessly into death. And he saw all that and came back as a staunch opponent of the war, and kind of like, I can't remember exactly, but I feel like there was a sense of him coming into his own as a gay person. Not really, like, I don't get the sense that he lived that way before the war. And what I really remember most about it is it kind of like wrestling with the limits of a certain type of gay culture, where like he's surrounded by all these incredibly clever, very charming people who are endlessly entertaining, but he doesn't really get any kind of like spiritual or emotional fulfillment out of it, and doesn't really know where to put that. And that to me felt very autobiographical for Davies.
There's very little. It reminds me of the boys in the band in some way, in the way that there's like a community of gay men, but also there's a cutthroatness to it at the same way, at the same time. These men are like friends, but also they can't. They can always trust one another.
Yeah, they're all friends and potential lovers, and thus potential opponents for each other's affections.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see that explored in this milieu of this period in time, where it's like, it's not like D.H. Bosser is Looking or whatever, where it's like a contemporary setting. To a degree, these people are all living closeted lives. probably in an environment where they can be a little more open about it, but not much, you know, and there's certainly no hope of like marriage at the other end. There's a sense of like impermanence to any relationship they could get into and a sense of like finality to it.
Yeah, that's but that's not to say there's not marriage in the film, which is kind of a depressing end that sort of like, I don't know if I'd go so far as to say loveless, but certainly a sexless marriage.
Yeah, I mean, there's a, especially early on in the relationship, there's a degree of affection and understanding and sympathy. Yeah. But yeah, definitely like, it's kind of like where he turns to get that sense of fulfillment that he is not finding in his gay life, but also can't find it there either.
Great cast. Simon Russell Beale is in it as well.
Yeah, I mean,
R.I.P. Julian Sands is in it.
Yeah. I mean, Jack Lowden in the main role, I think, is incredible. Yeah,
Jack Lowden and Jeremy Irvine from weird to mention War Horse twice in this episode, but Jeremy Irvine from War Horse plays
twice in a year.
Yeah, he plays Ivor Novello, the only person depicted here that I had actually heard of.
Sure,
the actor who is the titular lodger in Alfred Hitchcock's. Roger.
And was played by Jeremy Northam in Gosford Park.
Oh, I did not put two and two together. That was the same. I haven't seen Gosford Park since it was new. I did not realize that. Mm. And it just, I mean, it, obviously when Terrence Davies made this, he didn't know it was his last film. But there is, with the occasional inclusion of like, stock footage from the time.
Yeah.
It does feel like it goes back to his like early features, like especially Long Day Closes with like dropping in audio that's non-diegetic and stuff like that. It felt like it had Benediction is even though over the course of his career you can see his movies becoming more straightforwardly narrative, Benediction does bring back some of these flourishes while maintaining all of the other flourishes that have been in his movies, especially the symmetrical framing and blocking, and the beautiful use of light.
Yeah,
that's been there the whole time.
Yeah, I do think you notice him a little bit more hemmed in terms of the budget. I remember a sense in which like if you point the camera like a quarter inch in either direction, you'll see 2021. There's like very minimal sets and all that kind of thing, which is fine. But yeah. It's kind of sad after like kind of the sweeping, especially Sunset Song, which is like. So much outdoors and huge vistas and stuff like that. This is like, okay, Davies is once again reckoning with not being a commercial force.
Yeah. I mentioned all these people in the cast and I didn't mention Peter Capaldi, who plays the elder Sassoon, and he's fantastic as well.
And that's a good title too. The Elder Sassoon.
Tom Hiddleston was in that miniseries on Apple TV.
You didn't watch it? Missed out.
All right.
Quick observation.
We did it all. Okay.
Quick observation. What was the name of the documentary again?
Of Time and the City.
Okay. So, have we ever done an episode about titles?
I don't know.
I feel like it'd be worth
it. I love that at some point our conversations went from we should do an episode about to have we done an episode about it? At a certain point, creeping up on 900 episodes, it does start to...
There's a definite shift.
Yeah.
Because, with a couple of exceptions, I feel like Terrence Davies, maybe like, even his titles have an auteur quality to them.
Sure.
Like, they're very elegiac.
Yeah.
Like, okay, like, with, again, a couple of exceptions, but Distant Voices, Still Lives, The Long Day Closes.
Yeah.
All right, and then obviously Neon Bible and House of Mirth don't really have that quality to them. But Time in the City, and then The Deep Blue Sea.
Yeah.
A Quiet Passion, Sunset Song, and then Benediction.
Yeah.
Like a lot of it has to
also
do with,
don't forget Death and Transfiguration, the short film. Yeah.
And just like there's this quality of stillness and a quality of things ending. Benediction, A Long Day Closes, stuff like that. And it's just, I don't know, it's something I don't think about very often, because I feel like for the most part, most filmmakers' titles are pretty different from one film to the next. But if you add up all of Terrence Davies' titles, again, with a couple of exceptions, they all kind of add up to a very specific type of tone that I think his films absolutely live up to.
That's a great observation. I'm glad that we did this. I'm glad that Tyler has discovered a new favorite filmmaker.
Absolutely.
I look forward to you seeing some of these other films that you would love as well. I also look forward to... I think I have a couple of new, like, favorite films that might find their way onto my... If I redo my top 100, there's a couple of those in here. And then also for rewatchability, I'm looking forward to rewatching A Quiet Passion again. It's just very fun.
It's a blast.
Yeah, that's that. Thank you, Scott, for doing this with us. Let's see, you can find us at battleshipretention.com. You can find reviews of some of these movies. I reviewed The Deep Blue Sea. I don't know if I stand by it. but I also reviewed Benediction much more recently, and I'm sure I stand by that. I think Aaron Pinkston reviewed A Quiet Passion. I know Alex has written about Terrence Davies multiple times in his Criterion Predictions and other things. There's a lot of Terrence Davies related writing at battleshipretention.com that you can find.
I do remember your reading your review of The Deep Blue Sea, and I agree. I don't think you should stand by it, because the whole time you're just complaining about the lack of sharks.
Yeah, right? Well, that's the key flaw.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was looking for those sharks, no one gives a scrambled egg recipe. let's see. Yeah, that's battleshipretention.com. You can follow me, David, on Twitter and Blue Sky at David Pretension, on Letterboxd at David Backs. Check out my other podcast, The One Where I Met Your Mother, where I talk about a couple of TV shows with my wife. Tyler, what do you want?
You can find me at More Lessons, which is where I tweet most often. And then let's see. By the time this goes up, I will have a new review at Rediscover Television, the blog, and it will be a review/retrospective on Fritz Lang's Sunset Street. Scarlet Street, pardon me.
You got Sunset on the brain.
I do. It's my favorite time of day because night's coming. Scarlet Street, which is obviously a masterpiece.
Yeah.
And you can read my review of that. And I also wrote a pretty scathing review of Rebel Moon on that blog as well.
Sure.
Don't forget Tyler's GoFundMe pinned to the top of the homepage at battleshipretention.com.
Yes, people have been very, very generous.
Way to go, people.
But we still have a ways to go. So anything you can give will be going towards some kind of therapy, whether it be...
Well, you can watch a video that says exactly where the money is going to go.
That's right. Yes,
helpful.
Thank you.
Yeah. Scott, what do you got?
Twitter and Blue Sky, Rail of Tomorrow, Letterboxd, Scott Nye, and Battleship Pretension. I just got a review up of the new Chantal Ackerman set that Criterion put out, which is awesome.
All right. Well, thank you at home for listening.
We'll get you next time.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.